몰라서.
So this morning I gave a very brief account of a quite remarkable but not particularly renowned man, this Franklin Marowolf, very intelligent, very gifted, especially in mathematics, in terms of his professional training. And as we saw, he was raised in a very Christian household with background, but then moved out of that. And so what's remarkable about that, I haven't seen many accounts like this that really strike me as authentic, and this one does, that when he did express as much as he could in words what he had experienced, it was actually in rather secular language. You couldn't say, definitely that's Advaita Vedanta, or that's Christian, or Buddhist, or anything else. He was really coming out of a philosophical training, and his philosophical studies were largely, he really focused on Kant, one of the three legs of the tripod of Hilary Putnam, you might recall. So I think that was rather easy to listen to. It probably didn't rub you the wrong way particularly, because it was something kind of a little bit ethically neutral. But this whole theme of Rangjung, Rangjung Nanjorba, or Nanjorma, which is in the feminine, of course, then a self-emergent yogini, it really appears to me to be something of a universal phenomenon. That is, it's not confined to any particular religious tradition, not necessarily even a religious tradition. Franklin Marowolf was definitely influenced by Advaita Vedanta, but what's interesting, after all his reading, and he was very, you know, very serious student of it, although I think, again, he had very little instruction, the first experience he had, his first realization, it made total sense to him. That, okay, this is what Advaita Vedanta is all about, yeah? And then he thought, well, good, now he's kind of expecting it to taper down, because that array of experiences he's had, I think more than experiences, my sense is realizations, took place over a 100-day period. And again, right halfway through his life, 49 years before, 49 years afterwards. But when he had that second one, what he called the second realization, which, if we gave it one term, his term was high indifference. Hence, that's why we covered it this morning. That came as a total surprise to him, because he thought he was already finished. He thought he'd realized nirvana. This is what Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth are all about. This is the ultimate. You've realized the divine within. And he thought that was it. And so when the second one came up, that was utterly unexpected. And he thought maybe it was unique. He thought maybe nobody had ever experienced it before, because he hadn't read about it. That's why he was really quite surprised. But the theme of Rangjung, this term self-emergent, it comes up a lot in Dzogchen literature. There's another one, another individual who's one of my lamas, who is widely regarded, and I'm certain with accuracy, regarded as Rangjung Nanjorma, and that is a self-emergent yogini. And she's simply known as Kandola Dakini, Venerable Dakini, Kandola. And she lives in Dharamsala. And I think I've mentioned her. A number of you have had the great good fortune to be in her presence. All spontaneous. And she's unusual in the sense that she's also a medium. She goes into trance and she channels a being. It's one of the Demachunike Nane, Demachike, Tupasotisre, Panalamo. So she has a very strong connection with, Kandola has a very strong connection with Sri Devi, or Panalamo, and is considered to be an emanation of one of her 12 kind of attendant goddesses. Well, of course, I don't know anything about that, but I know, well, when I was with her, I knew purity. I knew just utterly radiant, pristine purity. And the wisdom that came from her just spontaneously was just, I found it astonishing. And I've had good teachers. And this is only a few, it's several years now. But nevertheless, I'd had many, many marvelous teachings from many, many marvelous lamas when I met her. And when I sat with her for 1 hour and I got to translate for her, there were only five of us, and I was the interpreter. We were all just so profoundly moved. So you see, they're not calling her this casually, but she didn't have any training for that. It just came up spontaneously. Now she's very much under the wing of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I think she is certainly getting further counsel there. So such individuals crop up. But I thought, just for balancing sake, since I mentioned Franklin Marowolf, raised a Methodist, He bailed on that and then had his realizations. I was raised as a Baptist, bailed on that, no realizations, but still working. I thought it might be useful just to spend 5 minutes, something like that, with some other little nuggets I pulled out of the great ocean of the internet. I actually learned something more than I learned something from doing it. Because I've known about Jacob Boehme for a long time and know that he was quite remarkable, but never really checked out, you know, much at all. I'm just doing other things. But he was remarkable. He was German. He lived in the 16th to 17th century. So, right that period between Galileo and Newton, 16th century especially, died in 1624. He was the son of a peasant. He, as a youth, he was kind of on the career track to become a herder, cows, whatever. Didn't like it that much, so he tried to go for an upgrade, and he got an apprentice as a shoemaker. So that was maybe higher. And that was it. He had very little formal education. I mean, shoemaker doesn't need a whole lot. But he was literate, that. I didn't know that, but he was literate. But he, and I'll just read this, he had a number of mystical experiences throughout his youth. So again, it's Rangjung. He wasn't a monk. He had no special great yoga, you know, some great contemplative or mystic guiding him and so forth. They just occurred spontaneously, and they culminated in a vision in 1600. So he would have been clearly 25, born in 1575. So when he was 25, he'd already had a number of these visions, you know, just spontaneously arising. And he was raised as a Lutheran. And never stopped. That's why I'm citing him here. That, yes, also within mainstream Protestant Christianity, you know, these self-emergent yogis may emerge there as well and remain Lutheran. That's interesting. Because Luther himself he was a monk, and there's a whole story there that's interesting. I won't go into it. But he was a monk and completely abandoned. He married a nun. Got her out of the nunnery by putting her in a barrel and rolling her out. You know, this guy was not into monasticism. When he left vehemently, because it was all this self-brutalization and all that kind of business. He got totally fed up. And he tried so hard. I am going on a tangent. And he said, "This doesn't work. You know, I've done 100,000 of this and 100,000 of that, and it just doesn't work." You know? And so he threw the baby and the bathwater and the whole bathroom out all together. No, and he married this ex-nun, defrocked the nun, and they had a whole slew of kids. And, you know, then he was happy. But he had no interest in meditation or any of the business. He just, the whole thing, no thank you. And so it does not play a role in the whole Lutheran tradition ever since. And so here's Jacob Boehme raised as a Lutheran. So he had these culminating in a vision in 1600 as one day he focused his attention upon the exquisite beauty of a beam of sunlight reflected in a pewter dish. So after our conversation about moonlight reflected in the water and so forth, it's kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool. Now some of you are kind of wondering, what kind of pewter dish? Can I buy one? That's what we do in the 21st century. What was a pewter dish? Can I have it? You know, I want to look there too. Because we're looking for shortcuts everywhere. That's the nature of modernity. And so this was a very epiphanal, I think that's the word. It was an epiphany, the one in 1600. And here's what he said. I'll just read it through. And I'm not going to really comment, and I'm not saying this was Dzogchen. I'm not interpreting it. I just read it in his own words and a good English translation, because, of course, he wrote in German. If you want to know about heaven and what heaven is and where it is, you do not need to cast your thoughts many thousands of miles off, for that place, that heaven thousands of miles away, is not your heaven. The true heaven is not a created place, but an uncreated place. And it is not found in a particular place, but everywhere, even in the very place where you are standing and going. For when your spirit within yourself is able to penetrate inward through and beyond your own flesh and life, and is able to catch hold of the innermost moving of God, then you are clearly in heaven. Moreover, if your eyes were but open, you should see God everywhere in his heaven, for heaven is found everywhere. Well, a little comment, pure vision. Well, I don't know what else you could possibly call it. He continues, moreover, this unity is found throughout the universe, for all that there is, both here and throughout the universe, is in essence one person manifesting himself. One might call that the all-creating sovereign. I'm going to give a bit of comment, because when it seems so obvious. This seemingly outward universe is nothing more than the Godhead playing the joyous melody of his life through his creative instruments, which are all of the varied physical forms found throughout the universe, especially the form known as man, which he always intended to be his highest song of praise to his eternal and uncreated glory. So you see that wherever you are in this world, you are in heaven. And then finally, not much here. I mean, he has a lot, but I'm just giving a short nuggets. I'm just pulling from the sand. So, little children, if you now want and desire to draw near by faith to the life of God, listen. You must enter inward into the depths within yourselves wherein Christ dwells, not without. For within you there exists an eternity, even as there is an eternity within him. So you must go into the depths of the hidden secret place within you, to the very depths of the abyss of the eternal willing in the Father, which is God's desire and the source of all things. So that's all. But I do find it interesting that here's a devout, mainstream Lutheran. And that's the way he expresses within his familiar worldview what he experienced. Now, one could go on and on. I could spend easily the rest of this coming up with one more, and I don't think I will. I don't know what's coming tomorrow, but that's not my plan anyway, to kind of to find a Sufi and a Hindu and a Taoist and so forth. The point is being made. I think the point is made. But here we are this is a kind of training. This is not just kind of sitting around waiting for finding the right light beam or the right sandal or whatever. This is a real training. And that often I have looked in vain. Maybe I just didn't look hard enough. So I didn't find, but I didn't necessarily find the unfindability in various traditions, especially the Abrahamic traditions, of, that there are these mystical experiences, and there are many of them. And then the question I've often asked is, what were they doing? What were they doing that gave rise to it? What were the conditions? It's a perfectly good question. This must be an effect. What was the cause? And very often, with some exceptions, I've just not been able to track down what exactly they were doing. I remember when I was a lecturer at the University of California, Santa Barbara, I attended one seminar by a very, very good scholar, very smart, very, very fine, rigorous scholar. And one of his areas of specialization was Neoplatonic Christian mysticism from the 8th century, John Scotus Eryurigena. And I read some of it. And brilliant. I mean, really, very deep. So resonant with Dzogchen from my perspective. And I asked the professor himself, here we have these accounts of John Scotus Eryurigena's experience, these mystical visions. And I asked him and said, and he's an academic, a straight academic, the professor. And I asked him, what was he doing? What were the practices that gave rise to this? And he turned to me and said, we don't ask those questions. He was actually quite upset with me. He clearly was. That, we don't ask those questions. We just read what they say, and then we comment. So what we have here is something different. It's where I'm very content that other people are in academia and doing wonderful work, and I'm not, and I'm doing what I like. That's good. That worked out well. Actually, very well, actually. I'm very, very content. But what we're doing here is a path. And it starts in an utterly sensible way. And if we don't start there, we're not starting anywhere at all. And it's ethics. It's really cultivating a way of being in the world, responding to the world, with nonviolence and benevolence. And there's really nothing much more to Buddhist ethics than that. There's a lot of detail, enormous detail. But it really is all commentary on nonviolence and benevolence. Pretty much that's it. And so the practice that we've been doing here for the last 7 weeks If, as a result of the time we spent together here, if as a result of that, we are, when we leave here, less violent, even in our thoughts, even in sarcasm or condescension or expressions of contempt and so forth and so on, let alone physical, if we're less violent and more benevolent, then this is 8 weeks of tremendous value. That's, and I'm certainly including myself in that. So it's first of all ethics. And if, insofar as one makes strides there, regardless of worldview, that's got to be in the right direction. It's just got to be in the right direction. It can't not be. On the basis of that, then we're cultivating this second of the higher trainings, namely the higher training in samadhi, which is, as I've said before, has two meanings. One is really the narrow meaning of being highly focused. Another one is kind of, it's the unification of the mind. It's sanity. It's exceptional sanity. And I would include in that cognitive, which is everything about motivation, desire, intention, attentional, obviously. A cognitive balance, you know, and I've talked about that, emotional balance. And so samadhi, I would say, is really, it's exceptional, it's cultivating exceptional sanity, which is good no matter who you are, where you are, what kind of culture you belong to, whatever worldview. To be sane is better than to be insane. To be mentally balanced is better than not. And that goes for one's desires, and one's desires are meaningful, authentic, reality-based. That would be a good idea. And for the other three. And so that's my understanding, that on the basis of ethics, if you don't have that, then I've stopped talking. But if you have that, then first of all, be ethical, on the top of that, be sane. I mean, and then be exceptionally sane, be extraordinarily sane, be wildly, outrageously sane. But that's going to be good, because no matter what, it's going to be good. And on the basis of that, as one moves into the realm of vipassana, really attending closely to reality, then of course the next stage is to become wise. The sane really includes the benevolence. The sane includes compassion. It includes the four immeasurables and so forth. So we didn't overlook that. And of course it starts with benevolence. But then there's this culmination within the three higher trainings of wisdom, that one is simply seeing more clearly, attending more clearly, with deeper insight, seeing things as they are. As the Buddha said, the mind that is established in equilibrium comes to see reality as it is, and your samadhi comes out of ethics. Ethics supports samadhi, samadhi supports wisdom. So you become more wise, and that's whether you're a Muslim, a Christian, an atheist, agnostic, whatever, become more wise. That's got to be a good thing. And this entails intelligence. Intelligence is implicated, because it's the same word. Prajna means psychologically intelligence, and spiritually it's being perfected as wisdom, right? And so this training here, this training is designed to make us gifted. In the Buddhist view, if there's a child who's born as a genius in mathematics, and of course that happens, music, mathematics, science, and so forth and so on. From the Buddhist view, yeah, well, it's not just you're lucky, you had good genes, you have great parents. You built up a whole lot of momentum in mathematics from your past life. And that was probably a lot of hard work, studying and just working and developing and developing and developing. And so by the time you come to the end of your life, you're very, very capable, highly trained, very sharp mathematician. And then if that's still your passion, you're not finished, like Bach clearly wasn't finished, Mozart wasn't finished, that's what you really love to do, you had an ethical life, then welcome, you'll be one of those with 160 IQ and with a real knack for mathematics, you know, and be doing advanced mathematics when you're 5 years old. But not just because God likes you, but or anything like that. It's momentum you've built up. We can build it up in a myriad of ways. And so for the simple practices, they are not easy, but they're simple and they're very profound. We're building up momentum. For ethics, we may be born then in the next life very ethical, prodigies of ethics, you know. Born next lifetime, really coming in really composed, really balanced, really mature psychologically. Some children are born with wisdom. And so we're making ourselves more and more gifted, so that this self-emergent primordial consciousness, and it's always called that, yeshe, self-emergent, rangjung yeshe, and yeshe, those two are the same thing. Yeshe isn't something you condition, you build up, you construct, and then you create it. Yishe, primordial consciousness, is always something that simply just is simply manifesting. Just like when intuition arises. You didn't say, okay, I'm going to turn my intuition crank, let's see what happens. It's not something you create, it just, there it is. There it is. Well, I'm suggesting intuition is the tip of the iceberg of primordial consciousness. So the long and the short of it is that in this path, I look at it, of course, I love this path, but it starts with ethics, and I say, that's a good place to start. I can't think of any better place to start than that. And then it goes for sanity, and we see how, you know, sometimes we're really quite crazy. We do things really idiotic, foolish, like, what are you, out of your mind? The answer is, yeah. You know, and sometimes it's with a bit of help of alcohol or this or that or the other thing, but we're just coming in with conate afflictions, and then we can acquire, you know, all kinds of acquired delusions. As one I just read it this afternoon, BBC online right now, about how scientists are seeking to create thinking machines. Okay, I think, you know, artificial intelligence, cool, it can be helpful, why not? Stephen Hawking thinks it's going to be the end of the human race, but he may be wrong. You know, that the robots will take over and just kill us. You know, what do you need you for, you fleshy, stinky people? You know, and they'll just kind of say, you know, we'll be the prime director, get them out of the way so they can reproduce. I have no idea whether he's right or not. But what really caught me at this for the thousandth time is how the ease with which the author, without a pause, says they're now creating computers that they can see and they can know and they can understand and they interpret. Right? And never a pause. Because when I say Claudio just sees my hand, and he understands that I'm waving, and he interprets this sign. And what was the other one? See, understand. There was another one as well. Learn. So I can teach you sign language, maybe. You know, that whenever we use those terms, whenever, I mean literally, whenever until about 1950. Whenever you use those terms, it's always assumed, of course, that somebody is aware. Whether it's a dog, a cat, but somebody is aware. You're knowingly learning, knowingly interpreting, knowingly seeing, understanding. Of course. But now they're taking their, with an act of cognitive imperialism, they're going into human life, taking our cognitive verbs that they belong to our territory. This is for us sentient beings. They're taking them and using exactly the same terms in exactly the same ways for machines. And anybody who hasn't thought deeply about this would say, oh, well, gosh, they can think and they can learn and they can understand and they interpret and they see. Wow. I guess I am a computer too, except for I'm a smelly one. It's getting old and stinky, whereas they're all stainless steel and like that. So I'm really quite astonished. They'll do this and never justify it. They never say, by the way, we're using these words metaphorically because this is a mindless machine that's mimicking our cognitive activities of understanding, interpreting, seeing, and knowing, mimicking that. But of course, they don't understand, think, or see anything. They never say that, though. This is a scam, but I'm not blaming the author. I don't even know what it is. I didn't even know it. I don't care. But it's a self-scam. It's a self-scam. Because the people writing this haven't paused to think, are these verbs justifiable? Have they found the algorithm that makes a computer or a robot actually see? Like I look at Roberta's sweater and I can see it's the color of rust, of tan. An orangish color, I can see it, appearances, you know? They don't even address it. This is what arouses a passion in me, that it's not being straight. But it's not like they want to delude us, that just something got in us, like a mental virus, that they're using these terms without ever justifying them. But then people who are, you know, just trusting, it's MIT, it's Stanford University. We're taking refuge in these places. Really, we do. Stanford, MIT, Cambridge University. And so when you see these top scientists working on artificial intelligence are creating machines that can understand, interpret, and they're making eyeballs so the computer can, the robots can see. Unless you've thought deeply about it and you have not been brainwashed, you'd say, but no, that's a facsimile of seeing. And I checked out a little bit. And I think this whole delusion could be not dispelled, but it could be a good remedy, would be to show that, you know, these are just computing devices. That's all they do. They compute. It's digital, and they compute. That's why they're called computers, because they compute. Mindlessly, they compute. Like this, my little cell phone here can compute 2 plus 2 does 4 without understanding what addition is and without understanding 4. It's just a mindless mechanical operation that's been programmed by somebody who does know what 2 plus 2 is, right? But it just occurred to me, there's something called a Turing machine. And I just checked it out, and somebody's made a Turing machine of wood and scrap metal. Now, my understanding is a Turing machine in principle, could perform anything that complex computers do, right? So imagine that you had somebody coming up with a robot or a computer. This is a thought experiment. But imagine, and they say, this computer sees, and it thinks, and it remembers, and it interprets, and it learns, and it knows. And then, so show me. And you saw this thing made out of wood and scrap metal. Would anybody in his right mind think, hello, how are you? Wood and scrap metal. Would anybody think that there's some subjective experience there, that complex configuration of wood and scrap metal actually knows something? And I think the whole mystique would be gone. But because we look at a slick little Ferrari of an instrument like this, and we don't know what's inside, then we think maybe what's inside there is kind of like what's inside my brain. And after all, I'm a brain. Therefore, that must be a very cool brain. So that's just learned delusion. The point here, though, and summing up, is that when I read about people like Franklin Merrill Wolfe, no context. He was on his own, and he didn't know anybody who had experienced that until he learned about Dzogchen, but he didn't really have much contact with Tibetan Lamas. Or Jacob Boehme, he was on his own. Of course, he got severely criticized for his, you know, making statements from his own experience, kind of frowned upon. Whereas here we have a training that can make us as ripe as possible. And what it entails is, first of all, modifying the way we engage with reality by way of our behavior, body, speech, and mind. Modifying the mind to make it more balanced and in tune with reality. Probing into the nature of reality, so our vision of reality corresponds more closely to what is actually happening. Setting us up, so that we are primed to have one of those spontaneous experiences. Right? We're primed for it. We're making ourselves ripe so that we'd just be sitting out on a bench watching the sun go down and there could be a shift. We could go into really sweet meditation of awareness, and there could be a shift. We could just be going for a walk quietly and there could be a shift. We're making ourselves prone to these self-emergent breakthroughs, which always come as a gift. If you believe in God, it's grace. If you believe in Buddha nature, it's your Buddha nature manifesting. You know? But the beauty of this, the strength of this, why I'm all in and I'm in for keeps, is that here is something that continues to take us by the hand. You know, you get to the point where you've broken through to Rigpa. They don't just say, congratulations, you know, we'll start worshiping you. You say, oh, good, well, read the next chapter. And it's practice. How do you go deeper? How do you sustain that? How does the insight deepen from there, right? And it deepens, and then you say, actually, read the next chapter, the one taste, right? First yoga, single-pointed yoga. Second yoga, freedom from conceptual elaboration. So you're viewing it from outside the matrix, viewing these appearances from outside the matrix of samsara and seeing them all as displays, and then deepening to one taste, the whole of samsara and nirvana with no preference, and then go deeper from there. To no meditation. And that's the culmination, the final yoga being no meditation. That's the Mahamudra route. But what it does is, you know, it sets you up for that spontaneous outflow, that spontaneous emergence of a breakthrough of insight. And then it doesn't just strand you, let alone condemn you, but says, good, and now take my hand, and we'll take you to the next, and the next, and the next, all the way to Rainbow Body, you know, in one lifetime. So that, I think, we could spend all the rest of the next week with one more inspiring story from one more, from all over the place, inside religion, outside religion, Christian, Muslim, Taoist, and so forth and so on. And what we're smelling is the fragrance of the flowers, or we're seeing the fruits. But in many, many cases, it's hard to see, but what were they doing? How did that happen? How did they become gifted? How did that happen? And once it happened, what did they do then, and how did they deepen? And that, how did it happen, and what happened afterwards? And how do they continue and go deeper? Often that's hard to find. It's hard to find. I'm not saying it's unfindable, I'm just saying it's hard to find. Whereas in a book like this, it's not hard to find, just turn the page, you know, all the way up to achieving Rainbow Body. Just turn the page. That's pretty easy. And there you are. So that makes this really quite precious. And I'm inspired by the thought that these practices, especially these very sleek practices, free of conceptual elaboration, that, you know, anybody could practice them. Anybody could. And the vast majority of very decent people know that nonviolence and benevolence are good. The vast majority of people, religious and non-religious, they know, generally speaking, yeah, that's good. That would be good. That would be good for all of us. If we all live that way, that would be good. And so to be cultivating that on that common ground, and then recognizing, and one can go from a secular way, as we do in the Cultivating Emotional Balance program that Paul Ekman and I developed. It's secular. But people recognize, yeah, cognitive, attentional, cognitive, emotional, to be balanced, we'd be better than not balanced. That'd be good. So they don't have to, you know, make a leap into religious faith, just that'd be good. And then from there going deeper into practices like mindfulness of breathing, there's no strings attached, no, you have to believe this first. Start observing your mind in that way, no strings attached. Awareness of awareness, how is that a Buddhist practice? It's your awareness. It's not a Buddhist, you don't have to bring a Buddhist awareness to it, just awareness. And then not doing, well, how many ways of not doing are there? Buddhist, Christian, Protestant, Gelugpa, how many ways are there to do nothing at all? You know, and then see, as Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, and the Benjana Rinpoche, just a short list, said, let your view come out of your meditation. And if you go in as a Muslim, come out a better Muslim. If you come in as a secular person, come out a really great secular person. You know? So that really inspires me, this, that the door is wide open, but it really is a path. And paths are not that easy to find. A lot of Dharma out there, a lot of very good Dharma out there. Paths and people teaching the path, I think my sense is not that common. Not like they really mean it. You know? And I mean it. You know that. Oh, Lhasa. So let's go on. That's enough of that. We have a good bit of text to cover. But I thought that was quite lovely. And I find it inspiring. I think he's Dharma brother. Much older Dharma brother than me. But still, he's Dharma brother. And so let's go to the next session. It'll be a bit of guidance. You don't need much. And this time it's going to be balancing sky and space. So we'll start in the normal way. Go right into just very simple awareness of awareness, right? Sky, as in earth and sky, right? Awareness of awareness. But I'd like you to see, and I'll give a little bit of commentary just to make it as clear as I can. When you're resting in awareness of awareness ever so simply, as a shamatha practice, which can possibly unfold into, if you're ripe, into a cutting through to pristine awareness, what's the difference then? Experientially, not just writing an essay about it, experientially, methodologically, what's the difference between simply resting in awareness of awareness and no meditation? Sky and space. What's the difference between sky and space? One has a color, the other one doesn't. One you can look at, the other one... So find a very comfortable posture, please. as we always do, settle body, speech, and mind in the natural states, and for a couple of minutes, very gently, soothingly, calm the mind, release the energy with every out-breath that underlies the conceptual turbulence of the mind. And let your eyes be gently open, evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you without focusing on any object. And rest for a little while, just simply doing nothing, just for a short time. Resting there with no interest in appearances or objects to the mind. Insofar as your mind does become quiet, then like the sun rising from behind your back, you may become more and more vividly aware of the unmediated experience of being aware. And so you rest in that knowing. Rest there knowing the two extremes in this shamatha practice, the extreme of simply being carried away by some thought or other appearance, leaving your throne, being abducted. There's one extreme. And the other extreme of just fading out or fading in, just sitting there with a blank mind, cultivating stupor. What's left between those two extremes is the practice in all its simplicity, clear, still, cognizant, and relaxed. For a couple of minutes, you may flex your muscles, and that is setting your own rhythm or picking up on the rhythm of the breath. Invert your awareness, concentrate, focus, attend very closely to this experience of being aware, of awareness itself. And then relaxing deeply, releasing awareness with no object. Arousing and relaxing, sustaining the flow of the knowing of knowing. With every out-breath especially, release any grasping onto thoughts, release the thoughts themselves, and sustain a non-conceptual flow of knowing. Now release or suspend, terminate the oscillation, the arousal, and the relax, and just rest. no object, no vector, no target of the mind. Just the awareness of awareness, single-pointedly. Then relax more deeply. Release the desire to sustain the awareness of awareness and all other desires. But listen long enough to know how to do that. Release all striving, all effort, all goals, hopes, and fears. Release any urge to modify, to improve, to cultivate or develop anything. Do not do anything. Do not focus your awareness in upon itself. Do not release it. Do not focus on space. Release all doing. All preference. And in the absence of all doing, there is only being. But it's not an act of will. It's not something you start and then stop. There is simply being aware, which entails a not doing of anything at all. It's what's left. So rest there, utterly at ease. With no expectations. And of course, on occasion, you're bound to be drawn into the habit of doing something. Some thought, some memory, which means you're not doing the practice anymore. There's no longer non-meditation. So as soon as you recognize that, then do something, since you're not doing the practice anyway, and then stop doing that. And just that, just stop doing. A simple negation. Because you don't need to do anything in addition. No additions. Just stop doing. So a skeptic might wonder if, in doing that practice, that your still desire is still there, because you're still doing the practice. And that sounds very reasonable if you've never done it. A lot of people try to figure out meditation by thinking about it. It doesn't work out very well. But in fact, it's not true. As really quickly, because I really want to get to the text, but in shamatha, just as an analogy, on the eighth stage, nine and then shamatha, on the eighth stage, it takes just a little bit of effort to start the session. Just like nudging. I've given the example of on a toboggan run. You have to push, and then you don't have to push anymore, because it's gravity takes over, right? But you do have to push a little bit, and then it's effortless. Same thing in the eighth stage. A little push, and then it's effortless for the rest of the session. Yeah? And so it's just like that. I mean, it's an analogy only, but still, at the beginning of the practice, would you like to do the practice or not? You don't have to. But if you'd like to, you can. And so you desire to do it, right? But once you've started, you don't need a push. You literally can continue with no desire. Because you slide. If you're standing at the door of an airplane and you're a sky jumper, you need a little bit of effort to step off the plane. After that, not really. Okay, let's go. We need to make tracks now. Let's go. All right, we're on page 137. Songzen Gambo. Very rare to hear a king being consulted for advice in meditation, but that's what he was. The most powerful king in the history of Tibet. Big empire. So Songzen Gambo says, the ultimate reality of Avalokiteshvara accords with Mahamudra. And the meditation is presented in terms of analogies together with their reference. This is used an awful lot in Mahamudra Dzogchen because they're leading you to the ineffable. So they're going to be using words in an unusual ways, and metaphors and poetry and imagery are classic. First, non-conceptual luminosity is like a butter lamp unmoved by the wind. In a butter lamp unmoved by the wind, the base of the wick is a flame. The shaft of the wick is luminous and the tip is sharp. Likewise, when the mind is left without modification, it is fresh, naturally lucid, and relaxed. That's first. And then second, that's kind of like your basic view. How are you viewing reality in that way? Then there's the meditation itself. Second, recognizing memories and thoughts as empty is like recognizing a thief. Due to recognizing a thief, he cannot steal. Like you recognize the thoughts, they can't steal you away. They can't kidnap you. You see them, oh, that's it. I see you, Mara, right? So recognizing memories and thoughts is as empty as like recognizing a thief. Due to recognizing a thief, he cannot steal. Likewise, whatever experiences of laxity and excitation arise by recognizing their nature as empty. So this is beyond shamatha. As empty, you're bringing in the muscle of the last chapter. And the last before that, the emptiness of these phenomena, recognizing their nature as empty, you abide in Mahamudra through mindfulness alone. And now you see this mindfulness is supercharged. Not that, just that wimpy mindfulness of shamatha, or the wimpy mindfulness of bearing in mind emptiness. You know, it's this resting in and sustaining the awareness of Rigpa itself, Rigpa knowing itself. So we have the view, the meditation, here's the conduct or lifestyle. There's the classic triad, right? View, meditation, and way of life, or conduct. The lifestyle is presented in terms of analogies together with a reference. The non-dual encounter, that is of awareness, recognizing awareness, pristine awareness, recognizing pristine awareness, is like the meeting of a mother and son. Once a mother and son recognize each other, there's no doubt about the matter. That is this incontrovertible knowing. When you come into it, when you really come into it, nobody could persuade you otherwise. So likewise, whatever appearances arise and whatever is called is recalled, and whatever is recalled in the mind, when recognizes them as Mahamudra, homogeneously, whatever comes up, whatever is called mind, whatever calls appearances, all now non-dually identified as Mahamudra. In the same vein, Songzen Gambo says, this Dharma of Avalokiteshvara is taught in accordance with the great perfection. Oh, so he did Mahamudra, now he's going to do Dzogchen. Encountering ultimate reality is like meeting someone you have known before. That and nothing else is ultimate reality. The condition of remaining without recognizing the ultimate reality of your own mind is to be understood like this. When you meet a man you have known earlier, you clearly recognize the man. Likewise, you recognize the ultimate reality of your own mind as ultimate reality, simply by the mentor, spiritual mentor, pointing this out. The reality of ideation arising as primordial consciousness is like fire spreading in a forest. So there's something, again, effortless. Fall out of an airplane, start a spark in a very dry forest, the rest is easy. Right? In the unceasing ideation of the present, there is nothing to be apprehended, nothing targeted. For example, if a fire is lit in a thick forest, all the shrubs and trees assist the fire. Likewise, all the coarse and subtle thoughts of the three times initially have no origination and are empty. In the interim, they have no location and are empty. And finally, they have no departure or no destination and are empty. So they arise solely as empty primordial consciousness. So you see how it brings it all together. Your shamatha is there, the vipassana is there, identification is there, and he's helping you now sustain it. The meaning of the self-releasing of signs is like water merging into water. All phenomena that appear as real signs, they appear to be really there from their own side, are nothing other than ultimate reality. For example, when once bubbles have arisen, they dissolve back into the water. Likewise, all phenomena arise from ultimate reality, and then all phenomena are released in their own state, or right where they are. They don't go anywhere. Thapo Rinpoche taught the meaning intended by Dombi Heruka, again one of the Mahasiddhas. He taught what Dombi Heruka had in mind, Gongba, Gongba. So just as water is lucid if it is not disturbed, lucid, transparent, clear. So just as water is lucid if it is not disturbed, rest without modifying the state of awareness. Like the sun, unobscured by clouds, rest in your own nature without inhibiting the six fields of experience at all times and during all activities. Be without distraction. So there is advice going on to your, into your post-meditative experience. When you need to get up, you need to have something to drink, eat, go for a walk. Okay, still, sustain this effortlessly. And without inhibiting, so there's no turning away here in this non-meditation. There's no turning away from appearances. There's no inversion of awareness in upon itself. You let everything, you let it be. The Venerable Thapa Gyanzen says, observe the mind of the mind that is mindless. Again, it seems eerily close to a Zen koan. But there it is. Conceptually, this is, I think, it points us in the right direction. If you see something, that is not the ultimate reality of the mind. Seeing without seeing is seeing the ultimate reality of the mind. Do not be distracted from the unseen mind. Good, that's a good response. The Venerable Sakyapenchen, that's the great Sakyapandita, says, when self-arisen or self-emergent primordial consciousness arises, all conceptualization turns into the nature of primordial consciousness. So again, this is not something imagined. That's what you do in stage regeneration, which is a lot of doing and modification and striving and aspiring, and this is not that. There is no difference between meditating and non-meditating, and ideation dissolves into the absolute space of phenomena. Gyeme Zhang, one of the great Tibetan adepts, he says, in Mahamudra meditation, there is no definite sequence. This is, again, this wonderful suppleness, malleability, absence of rigidity and dogmatism. I really love about this whole tradition. There is no definite sequence. There is no order or enumeration of preliminaries. So he's saying you don't necessarily have to go 100,000 rounds of this and that. Enumeration of preliminaries means that, right? There is no order of enumeration of preliminaries. Somebody asked me recently, which shall I do first? I'd like to do them. That's good. Which one first? Vajrasattva? Which one? He said, oh, relax. He's telling that to Tibetans. I don't know what he'd tell us, probably with a bullhorn. Relax. There is no order or enumeration of preliminaries, main practice, and conclusion. There's no need to calculate the time or date. Don't wait for auspicious days, you know, when you get like a million times more merit and slack off for the rest of the year. No, every day is your birthday. So there is no beginning, middle, or end. So there is no need to calculate the date. Whenever you remember, maintain your practice and be at ease. So it's so weird, like, just, you know, be persistent, relax. There is no beginning, middle, or end. Your mind, your own mind, is unborn and unceasing. So how could there be a beginning, middle, or the end of your practice if your own mind is unborn and unceasing? In the case of water in which silt has been raised up by waves, if you leave it to itself, it will become placid and lucid. In the case of your mind that is obscured with conceptualization, if you leave it in its own nature without modifying it, it becomes lucid. Do not modify it, but be at ease. Do not draw in your consciousness, but let it roam, let it off the leash. Do not crave anything, but let it be. Do not fix your attention on an object, but let it be. Do not engage in many activities, but simply be present. Without seeking a place to put the mind, let it be like space with no foundation. Do not think of the past, future, or present, but let your consciousness be fresh, always fresh. Not even having the notion, oh, I'm not going to meditate for 24 hours. That's hard. Whereas you know perfectly well, if I say between my finger snaps, you know how easy it is. It's easier than easy, right? It's that easy. And that's because it's fresh. And when you set the timer for 24 minutes, you got fresh for about 1 second, and then you lose the freshness. And that's hard. Losing the freshness is hard. Freshness is easier than easy. It's before even the thought of effort, before the thought of any differentiation between samsara and nirvana. Whether or not ideation flows out, do not intentionally meditate, but be loose. In short, without meditating on anything, let your consciousness be just as it is already. There is no need for anxiety about anything. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it right? If you're asking that question, I'll tell you with certainty, you're doing it wrong. If you're asking the question, you're doing it wrong. Because you're asking a good question. And you're doing something. Asking the question. It just struck me in this meditation. This is a simple negation. It is. Pet doesn't have any punctuation after it. It's not pet and that. So there is no need for anxiety about anything, but know that everything moves in the state of the Dhammakaya. The glorious Gurdsangpa says, in a relaxed and loose manner, place your consciousness in its primordial state that is inconceivable and ineffable. To place, though, it's just words. There's nothing grasped that is picked up and attended to, nor anything modified on which to place the attention. So it's hard to speak about that which is ineffable, and hard to use many words to tell you how to stop doing anything at all. But they keep trying. Because you have to hear it many times. For most of us, we have to hear it many times. And then finally, oh, I've heard that 100 times, and this time I got it. Apart from settling in the nature of being, there is nothing mentally created on which to meditate. There is no meditation on indistinct deities. There is no impossible recitation of an American trying to recite a Sanskrit mantra with a Tibetan accent. That's hard. Om Benza Sato. Then you sound like an American reciting Tibetan, reciting utterly mangled Sanskrit. I don't really see a whole lot of point, but if it works, it works. No ridicule. Doing it the Tibetan way, no wrong, nothing wrong with that. Otherwise, I'd be the only one right. I'm not. So there is no impossible recitation. There is no training in unmasterable techniques. Like trying to visualize yourself with a bunch of arms. Let alone visualizing 720 deities simultaneously in the body, speech, mind, mandala of Kala Chakra. If you tried that recently, it's hard. It's very hard. You know, the first 500, not that bad, but after that, it just kind of starts to get slower, you know, for some people. Let the mind settle in itself, let it be, without fabricating or managing anything. Although you are told to be present without structuring anything, you want to fabricate bliss, stillness, lucidity, clarity, non-existence, and emptiness. Stop that! Leave your mind fresh, relaxed, and naturally lucid. It is fresh because the newness has not been lost. That's clear. It's relaxed because it's effortless. And it is settled in natural lucidity because it is remedy-free. You're not trying to fix it. Another Tibetan master, what a bouquet. This is like a whole flower shop. Yang Gumba says, the essence of thoughts that suddenly arise is without any nature. Do not inhibit their appearance in any way, and without thinking of any essence, let them arise clearly, nakedly, and vividly. Likewise, if one thought arises, observe its nature. And if two arise, observe their nature. Thus, whatever thoughts arise, let them go without holding on to them. Let them remain as fragments. Release them unimpededly. Be naked without an object. Release them without grasping. This is close to becoming a Buddha. This is the self-extinction of samsara. Samsara is overwhelmed. Samsara is disempowered. Samsara is exhausted. Knowledge of the path of method and wisdom, appearances and emptiness, the gradual stages, the common and special paths, and the 84,000 entrances to the Dharma is made perfectly complete and fulfilled in an instant. This is self-emergent, for it is present like that in the very nature of awareness. Natural liberation is the essence of all the stainless paths, and it bears the essence of emptiness and compassion. The basis is the nature of existence that does not dwell in samsara or nirvana. The path, so the basis, that's the ground. Ground, path, fruition. The path is a union that does not dwell in samsara or nirvana. And the fruition is the transcendence of misery that does not dwell in samsara or nirvana. In an instant there is self-liberation of the nature of existence that is not created by anyone. This complete, unmistaken, definite path is called self-emergent, essential self-liberation. Recognize this very stream of ordinary consciousness as an unmediated, objectless phenomenon. It arises without anyone creating it. It is primordial, for it is originally pure. Because its nature remains like that, it is simply present, and meditation is self-emergent, primordial, and simply present. In such practice, it is important to rest the mind without distraction and without meditating. Meditating clearly has a connotation of grasping. So we come back to that theme right from the kindergarten. Settling the mind is a natural state. Rest without distraction, without grasping. It has a meaning. And then you go deeper and has a deeper meaning. Go deeper. The same words have deeper, deeper meaning as the whole level of your practice is elevated. If you are distracted, you remain an ordinary being. You've just been reborn, you remember? A little microcosm of a sentient being. If you're distracted, carried away by rumination, you remain an ordinary being. If you meditate, however you do it, it will be misleading. It will take you away from your own pristine awareness. In the state of not meditating, do not be distracted. So it's not, not, not. And what's left over is the practice, when you're not doing anything. And then siddha origin. Again, la. Di sita organ kada sa organ tutu la di ang guru me chiran re di jamba chi yorba kai kai ki re la kaju. This is what Gyatso Rinpoche told me, and I wasn't doubting him, but I just wanted to make sure. This is Well, let's be accurate. So again, I just reiterated what I thought I had remembered. But then I was looking, I wanted to be certain, because I really like not to mislead. And I looked and looked on the internet, and I couldn't find this organ. But there it is. We have two independent sources, and they're both very good. Gyatso Rinpoche and Lama Chanchub. This Siddha organ, it's not Padmasambhava. When it says organ Rinpoche, it is. I know it because they're citing a text I've translated. That gives me a certainty. But Siddha organ is another one. He's a Tibetan Gagyupa Mahasiddha. Okay? Different individual. Okay? La. Urgen la. La. Urgen pa. Ah, that's interesting. Okay? It's Urgen. Urgen is the land, Odiana, right? Urgen pa is a person from Urgen, just like Gelugpa, a person of the Gelugpa tradition. So it's Dutop Urgen pa. Then it's a Tibetan Gagyupa Mahasiddha. Now, you'll see his teachings are utterly in line with that of Guru Rinpoche. But it's good, just for accuracy's sake, don't conflate two different individuals, because that's what they are. Thank you so much, Gena. Really helpful. So I found his teaching really quite remarkably good. So let's do that today, and we'll call it a stop. This one, try to be in single-pointed samadhi here. This is really, really sharp. Really sharp. So he's laying this out in four phases. It's quite stunning. So let's just go through it. So here are the stages he's going to unpack. Rest in unstructured freshness. Let go of memories and thoughts. Transform diversity into an aid. Practice letting go of appearances. So first of all, rest in unstructured awareness. Be at ease like a Brahmin spinning yarn. That is, they're not working by the hour. They're not anticipating when's it over. They're just in the flow. It's exactly that. It's flow. Be like a Brahman spinning yarn. Be loose like a sheaf of straw for which the cord has been cut. Beautiful analogy. Classic. Be gentle like stepping on a soft cushion. Otherwise, you'll trap yourself as if you were caught in a spider's web. Even if you tighten up your whole body and mind like a woodcutter on the side of a cliff, you just fall on a cliff, you're holding onto something like that. Even if you do that, your mind will not want to be still. Even if you really say, oh, now I'm going to really do it. You bear down. You're just going to freak out the mind. It won't want to be. It won't be still. In a state free of meditation, free of a meditation object and a meditator, post a century simply by undistractedly withdrawing the mind and then evenly let it be. So this is the first stage, rest in unstructured freshness. Thus, awareness circles back to its own resting place, like a mother camel who's been sent away from her calf. It's a whole story there. And it's true that mother camels have intense attachment to the babies. If you take them away, they cry, and they cry, and they cry, and they cry. There's a whole film I saw about the film of the crying. Yeah, it's really intense. So if you finally let her go, she's going to go right back to her calf. It's a very strong attachment. And they literally cry, tears streaking down their camel faces. So therefore, the critical point of sustaining the tension is just knowing how to relax in a state of non-distraction without meditating. This is profound. Again, it is said that relaxed consciousness is not something easy. Except for you really smart Westerners, you'll nail this really quickly. We wish. All of our smartness doesn't help at all here. All of our education, what your IQ is, how good you are at crossword puzzles and so forth and so on, doesn't help at all. This is why Ganjan Dugur Rinpoche said, some of you don't know anything at all. Then you don't come in with all the baggage. So we can need it. Now we go, let go of memories and thoughts. This mind primordially exists as the Dharmakaya. The very forms of that are the six fields of experience arising as various memories and thoughts, and the mind moves after each of those objects. Once there arises in your mind stream the experience of all of them, recognizing their own nature in their own state, the essence of Mahamudra is seen. In such realization, there is no expulsion of bad things that are not meditation, and there's nothing to be affirmed or embraced or latch onto. Whatever thoughts arise, do not be distracted from them, but practice like the flow of a stream. Okay, there's phase two. Phase three, transform diversity into an aid. whatever appearances of the eight mundane concerns arise. So all this stuff that you find so irritating, distracting, oh no, in a week we're going home, I won't be able to handle it. He's saying, well, I hope you can get to a place where there are mundane concerns a lot, because that will help a lot. Get out of this cloistered place. Get away with this creepy American guy. Whatever appearances of the eight mundane concerns arise, do not regard them as a problem, but relate to them as aids. If you know that point, there is no need to make a point of seeking non-conceptuality, and there's no need to regard thoughts as a problem. Your awareness is then bountifully sustained without the onset of a famine of spiritual practice. So without seeking mental stillness, clarity, or joy, practice without rejecting or accepting anything that arises. Such ordinary consciousness is without fabrication or structure. This very self-illumination is the encounter with all phenomena. So this is why I'm very happy. This is practice. It's after the identification chapter, which is after the Vipassana chapter, which is after the shamatha practice. And you might think, well, why don't we just stop at shamatha and maybe kind of flirt a little bit with Vipassana? And the reason for it is our practice will be richer if we include everything here. You go home on Thursday, practice this on Thursday. As he said, there's no definite order. Thursday's not too soon. Right now, 3 minutes before dinner, not too soon. You know, at any time, this can be practiced too. I wouldn't suggest focusing only on this, because it will be probably hard to sustain. For many reasons, our tendency to reify slams this. The distractions, the dullness of the mind slams this. Unethical behavior slams this. Reifying ordinary appearances slams this. So everything that goes before this is just to enable this to be done effortlessly. Those are all preliminary practices to doing nothing at all. And then it's grace. Then it's grace. I mean, that's a nice word. Grace is a very graceful word. Christians don't have it, they don't own it. Or theists don't own it. This is grace from your own pristine awareness. Grace from all the Buddhas. Grace from Tara. Grace from all, they're all true. They're all fine. And then finally, practice letting go of appearances. Then all memories and thoughts, all appearances and all experiences of activities arise in the nature of Mahamudra. Just as no ordinary rocks are found on a golden island, the various phenomena of samsara and nirvana naturally do not lose their freshness. Their countenance does not change, and they arise as self-originated, conate, primordial consciousness in the nature of unfabricated, uncreated, primordial Mahamudra. Pui. Hallelujah. So, this book is worth more. If you had all of Bill Gates' money, but you couldn't buy this book or anything like it, or you could have this book, I would go for this one. You know? There's nothing wrong with having a lot of money. Nothing wrong. But if money couldn't buy a book like this, then it's just hedonic. So a book like this, there's nothing sectarian about what I said. But this one, poor. This is why Tibetans treat books, like I was with somebody today and they just had their notes or questions for an interview on the ground. That's not a sin, that's nothing bad. But I said, why don't you pick it up? Pick it off the ground. Like Tibetans, Ruah. Like Tibetan. These are your Dharma questions. And just a question, but still, this is the vehicle for Dharma. So Tibetans, traditional Tibetans, they treat any text. They take it off the ground. And why? Could be a newspaper. They didn't have newspapers in Tibet much. But it could be something that's just completely mundane. And they say, you know, yes, the content of this particular little scrap of piece of paper with the writing on it, it's not Dharma, but it could be. And therefore, they put it in a high place. That kind of basic stance of reverence, the basic stance of reverence, is such a boon. It's a virtue. Secular people, atheist people, sometimes, you know, they ridicule it. They, oh, it's superstition. They're just missing something, that's all. They're missing something. I see nothing to celebrate in the secular view of reality. If that's all people can stand, that's fine. If they can only stand very weak medicine, and anything stronger makes them sick, then the weak medicine's the best. And I say that with no condescension, just the way it is. But to celebrate the secular as like, oh, now we've outgrown religion. Ay, ay, ay. It's like babies just not, you know, babbling. not knowing what they're talking about, not having a clue. The sense of the sacred, the sense of reverence. In Tibet, you know, so many Tibet, if they would see a piece of cloth of a maroon color, they'd put it up in a tree. It could be, I'm not a monk, so this is just a robe. This is, you know, Lama's robe, but not monastic, of course. Everybody knows that. That's why I make a point of always wearing white, so nobody mistakes me like that, right? So this is not a Lama, this is not a monastic robe. It doesn't have that symbolism. Dikits, yes, mine no. Lama Chanchu, yes, mine no. But they see a fragment of this, and it could be that of a monk, and they put that in a high place. That's their expression of taking refuge in Sangha. I just see that as a sublime virtue, a sense of reverence that permeates your life, rather than once a week or when you go to the temple or you see some really special lama, you know? Because after all, if we're here to purify all appearances and our very sense of our own identity, then it's best not to walk backwards and to stay in that sense of the sacred. That's only a virtue. It's only good. Oh yeah. Ding.